guys, welcome to another episode of Central Coast in Court. This is the first episode of our second season. Welcome to 2020. We're so happy to be back recording podcast episodes, visiting new wineries, and sharing that all with you. So we hope that your new year has started off on a high note. And if it hasn't, hopefully you're listening so you can find really great places to drown your sorrows. Just kidding, but maybe only kind of. So this first episode that we're kicking off season two with was recorded at Court & Nell up in Templeton. Perfect spot. It's within walking distance, really. Like if you're at Tin City, you wouldn't need to Uber. Maybe if you've already gone to a couple stops, you would want to Uber, but you definitely don't have to. And we've been following them on Instagram for a while. I also have a friend who works next door. So I had heard about the Court & Nell labels and heard really good things about their wines and have been meaning to stop in and try and coordinate something and just didn't get around to it in our first season. So we were really excited to get a chance to go visit them a couple weeks ago. We walked in and met Tyler, who is the winemaker and owner, and he had baked fresh bread that morning. So we started off the tasting with a little bit of fresh bread that was still warm. It was amazing. And we had a really good tasting experience. The wines were great. Loved them. I can't think of anything I didn't like. I did take some extensive notes, so really excited to go back through those in the future. Definitely will be back to taste some more wine recreationally. I think it's a good spot to take friends. It's not huge inside, but they are so laid back and willing to cater to like what you're looking for that it'd be a good spot to, you know, take like two or three other people, or, you know, if you have a couple friends coming into town for the weekend, really good spot to take them, start there, then head into Tin City and finish off your day there at Barrel House or something. So we had a really great time, if you can't tell. And I think that that will come through in the episode for you guys. So without further ado, let's get into it. I'll catch up with you at the end. And you guys, don't worry. I realize that Jamie is not on this intro. She didn't drop off the face of the earth. She is just on vacation and could not be here with me to record this intro. So she will be back welcoming you to the podcast and our new season next week. And until then, I hope you enjoy this episode.
This is, we're bottling this Wednesday, but this is our 2018 white. It's Grenache Blanc Roussanne Vignier. We call it Pinwheel. It's our white rum blend. We committed on this vintage to extending the aging on our white wines in vessel. So typically white wines are bottled within like 9 months, 6 to 10 months generally. I think a lot of that has to do with like cash flow more than anything. Like you need something out, like you just spent all this money on harvest and you need to get something out there, and the white wine is ready enough. But that doesn't mean that if it just was left alone it couldn't be better. And so we've kind of adopted this full vintage concept where the white wines are aging longer than 12 months. So this wine was aged 14 months. It went through malolactic fermentation fully but spontaneously, so we didn't add any ML bacteria. And part of this process is not sulfuring this wine till you think you absolutely have to. So we didn't SO2 this until July. And then malolactic fermentation at that point was through. And then even then we kept it relatively low. And the idea too is to actually allow oxygen to interact with the wine to enhance texture, to create like a different flavor profile, evolve the nuances a little bit. And we're pretty excited on the product. So
how long did it take to complete malolactic?
We sulfured in July, so until July.
Okay.
So what would that be, like 10 months?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, because another thing is too, is that it's in the cold, it stayed only in the cold room, fermented in the cold room, aged in the cold room. Mm-hmm. So that's going to slow down malolactic fermentation as well. And then, you know, we do pick our whites earlier than we do our reds. So the pH is typically lower, which makes it a harder environment for malolactic fermentation to occur. Okay. So it wasn't ideal conditions.
Yeah.
And we didn't add any bacteria, so it had to go through naturally. It's a game of patience for sure, and risk, because white wines are more vulnerable in the vessel, so to not sulfur is definitely a loss of sleep here and there.
Yeah.
Don't add malolactic bacteria to anything.
Okay.
So we don't sulfur our reds generally until summer.
Yeah.
Either, and they're always in the cold room, and we never put them in the warm room. And the idea is that if it's stable, like if there's alcohol and the right amount of acid and not your pH isn't too high, and 3.8 is high but not too high, I wouldn't say, it'll go through eventually.
Yeah.
And so...
patience.
Yeah. And I think, too, that there's something to be said about the way the texture develops in that first 10 months without sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
That gives me enough reason to just not have to worry about it. Because really your only motivation to sulfur right away is because ML is done.
Mm-hmm.
But... we're not motivated to sulfur right away because it does so much for the texture of the wine to get that micro-oxidation early that we just don't add ML because it'll just go through. And so,
how long have you been making wine?
14 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Always in this area?
Always in Paso, yeah.
Okay, nice.
So I started at Dover Canyon Winery in 06, and I was offered a ton of grapes as my bonus, and that was my first vintage. And so I made my first 2 barrels there, and then 2 barrels, and 6 barrels, and then 9 barrels, and then 10 barrels, and so on and so on.
And how long has... So is it Cordant Nell, like, separately bottled?
Yeah, so it's 2 different brands. So Nell I started in 2006, so it's all Rhone varieties. Like, for example, this white wine would be a Nell
this
wine.
This is delicious, Thank by you. The way. This yeah. is very good.
Does Thank it have you. A name, or...?
Pinwheel. Yeah.
Sorry if you said that.
It's all right. And then in 2014... I started getting more curious about Pinot Noir, mostly because I didn't like the direction that Pinot Noir was going. Like, especially from this area, it started to get really cool to see how light you can make your Pinot Noir, and to me it doesn't really lend to that here. Like, part of our terroir is the sunshine and the length of our growing season, so if you're going to showcase terroir, you should be using those things instead of working against them. And so... So I was like, I want to make Pinot, and I'm going to make it big and bold and how I like it and how people I know like it. And so, yeah, so then I started making Pinot, and that's when Cordant started, because I started as a second brand.
Okay. And how did you come up with the names?
Nell is named after my mom.
Okay.
And it's also a common name on my mom's side of the family as a first or middle name.
Mm-hmm.
Cordant means to work in harmony. And so it's kind of a tribute to, I always want to pay tribute to there's so many working parts to this industry. And it's so much as it a place or a person that gets all the attention and glory, but it takes a lot of people, and from field workers to salespeople and everything in between. So it's kind of all those things are working together. That's when you make great stuff. So,
so where besides here can we buy your wines?
Well, so like Il Cortile or Syrah's by the Glass, okay. Psalm's Kitchen generally has one or two of our wines. They pour kind of by what the people are, what like who's there and what they're serving. So
yeah,
people,
that's a pretty fascinating experience.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that spot.
I was like, you're going to keep opening wine, okay.
Yeah. Generally, the Hatch has something of ours on tap. We'll do like keg wines exclusively for them. We don't necessarily do that, but for the Hatch. So Eric and Maggie were longtime friends, so of course we want to be in there, and it's a great spot. And so we do keg wines for them, and then we have, you know, we have Broker and Los Angeles, and we have various spots in Southern California, and we have a handful of placements in the Bay Area. We have a distributor in Texas, we have a distributor in Oregon, and yeah.
So if to buy, like if I want to buy a bottle to take to dinner, I need to come here and get it locally.
Unless you're going to Il Cortile.
Okay.
Or the Hatch, yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah, the tasting room is definitely the way I like to show the wines, because we created the space just for that, you know. So, and you know, we try to give people different experiences when they come in too. So even if you're a local and you've been in, like maybe we'll pour in the back one time, or we'll go sit at the table, or we'll just sit on. We call this little area out here our porch, which is just a drop leaf table and a bench, like, and we'll sit out there and and hang out and drink. Nice. And
yeah.
And too, sometimes if you've been a few times, we just say, what do you want? And we just crack that bottle and drink that bottle. Yeah. So.
How big is your wine club right now?
I don't really know. Okay. Yeah, I kind of...
You guys going to cap it? Or, like, are you getting close?
No, I mean, we're not... No, we'll just make more wine.
Still a business.
So, we only make about 3,000 cases of wine.
Okay.
But my goal, personally, is to get to 5,000. I think that's a good number to make it very manageable.
Yeah.
You can maintain quality, but also, you know, there's a buck to be made in that range, which is also not a bad idea.
Enables you to keep going.
You know, it's the Central Coast, and we all know how expensive it is to live here. So, you know, to buy a house one day, you gotta be ambitious. Unfortunately, but yeah, tasting room is the best bet for locals for sure. Yeah, just come on in.
Cool.
And our policy is to our hours are Thursday through Monday, 10:30 to 5. But Tuesday and Wednesday, if the doors unlocked, we're open. That's what it says.
Yeah, I saw that. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I can't see myself turning anybody away at any point.
That's so really cool. It's an it creates an inviting vibe for people.
All right, so we're gonna shift gears into some red wines. We're gonna start with the Central Coast Pinot Noir. This is a blend of multiple sites, 4 different vineyards, 2 in the Santa Rita Hills, 1 in the San Lucia Highlands, and 1 in Edna Valley. This is our Central Coast 2016 Pinot Noir.
How do you choose, like, which vineyards you, like, is it just based on where you're able to get fruit or what you're looking for?
We kind of hand select sites.
Yeah.
We do it 2 different ways. There's not a whole lot of vineyards that you don't know about. Like, you just know about vineyards because people talk and you just know what's where. And so sometimes there's a site that you covet and you just go out and you find a way to get it. Like, for example, one of our vineyards we source from is Radian in Santa Rita Hills. It's a site I coveted and you just find out who farms it and send a nicely worded email and see what happens. And so we're lucky enough to get into that site. And so then we also sourced from the San Lucia Highlands from a vineyard called Escol. And that was more by chance, where it was just kind of, I didn't have a lot of contacts in that area at the time, but I coveted the region. And so I just kind of asked around to some of the few contacts I did have in Monterey County, directed me to this vineyard, and now we've been sourcing there for 6 years. And have a really great relationship with them, and really dig the wines we make out of there. And then there's another thing is we go gem hunting, I call it. Like, especially in Monterey County, there's a lot of sites that are, like, just there that people don't know about for some reason and are really good and really interesting microclimates. And so sometimes I'll just drive aimlessly through the Monterey County area's wine country and just mark little tags of where I am and then try to find out through the contacts I have created, like, what site is this, what's out there.
Yeah.
And we found some really cool stuff that way. We get some Syrah from Arroyo Seco and Mesa del Sol vineyard that kind of fell in our lap through just kind of hunting around, and now it's one of our favorite sites. So
nice.
Yeah.
This is delicious.
Thank you.
So to me, like, it smells like a Pinot and it tastes like a Pinot, but it doesn't necessarily feel like it. Is that because it is a little bit heavier than, like, what I'm used to when I have a Pinot from around here?
Probably,
maybe, or...
Yeah. I would say it's, you know, it's picked riper, so it's going to be a little bit more opulent, and so it's not going to be overly linear and acidic.
Mm-hmm.
Some Pinots can just be overly acidic, in my opinion, especially when they don't need to be, which is kind of funny. And then also our winemaking is really geared towards texture more than anything, and so the pump overs are longer and slower. The time in barrel, again, there's minimal sulfurs and whatnot, and so spontaneous in mill, it contributes to that texture quite a bit, and so it widens the mid palate a little bit to do those things, and so that's kind of the point too, to have kind of more of a gradual curve of an experience with a big, you know, a big crescendo in the middle and a long finish.
Mm-hmm.
Is kind of the idea I like to do for wine.
I mean, it's easy drinking.
Yeah.
I'm
into it.
That's another thing, is trying to make the wines approachable in their youth, but something you could lay down if you wanted.
So how long would something like this be able to lay down? Like,
I would say this wine, so it's a 16, I would say you get 8 to 10 out of it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is that longer than a typical Pinot?
I would say that's on average for this area. Even the wines that are, like, leaner are, I don't think, would last much long past that because they don't have enough fruit to go along with it.
Yeah.
And so you would just end up with a vegetal weird wine where this, you might get a little bit more caramely and towards the end, but I think that 5 to 6 year mark is probably like the one you really want. So.
Right.
But also, like, when a wine is peaking is so subjective that I am apprehensive to even say these things because some people don't like old wine. Some people like young wine. Some people love old, weird, oxidized wines. And so who am I to say what's right or wrong? There's no... It's so case-by-case basis, so...
I really, like, last season, I was really advocating, and I stand by it. Like, I want my wine to have an expiration or best by date on it so that I know, like, if I take care of it,
yeah,
I need
to drink it. Yeah, but your expiration
date
is different than hers.
I know, but, like, it's so hard. Like, I don't know. I haven't had a collection long enough to know when I like to drink it. So I just want, like, I feel like if I like your wines and I trust your judgment, you just tell me when it's best, and that's when I'll drink it, and it'll be great.
Well, that's unfortunate, because I'll just tell you, I don't know. It's up to you.
I'll drink it now, and then buy more later.
Yeah, exactly. Buy six of them and have 1 year.
That's the thing. If you're not buying six or more bottles, then you're not collecting wine anyways.
Yeah.
Let's be real. I don't collect wine that way. I drink wine almost as soon as I get it. It doesn't matter if it's $150 a bottle or $10 a bottle. I usually just open it up.
I know. She always makes fun of me, because, like, we'll go somewhere, and we'll buy the same wine. Yeah. And then she'll be like, oh, I haven't touched that yet. And I'm like, oh, I drank that.
Yeah, that's gone. Like,
I bought that on Tuesday and I drank it on Wednesday.
Yeah, well, that's the average time a person ages wine. So, yeah, if you're not buying six bottles, then just drink it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Or I probably have 24 bottles that I just ignore. And that's, out of like 300, you know what I mean? So, in the end, there's probably another, most of the wine I don't even think I'll end up drinking.
Yeah.
Because it's just,
I have, I have wine fridges downstairs, and whenever I have a bottle I want to, like, save for either an occasion or, like, just for a while, give it a little time, I put it down there. I have no idea really what's down there.
Yeah.
I have, like, a rough idea. I know there's some, like, specific brands.
You're not, like, the spreadsheet person. That you're the spreadsheet
person?
She's
a spreadsheet. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised to find out she has a spreadsheet on my wine.
I'm all in. Awesome. This is
what's can you send me a quick inventory of your wine?
Yeah. I'm just, like, on my way home, I'll buy it, and I'll just stick it down there.
Yeah.
And do you like to drink your own wine?
Only time I really drink a good amount of my own wine is when we're leading, like, blending trials and stuff. I'll bring it home and try it more casually instead of in, like, the blending trial, space, headspace, and physical space. But I don't drink a whole lot of my wine socially, no.
Do you like it if you're, like, at a friend's house and they're like, oh, look, you made this, let's open it? Or are you like, come on, guys?
I'm always like,
work, and I don't necessarily want to hear your unsolicited opinion of my work.
Well, first of all, no one would be honest with you anyways in that setting.
They're
so, like,
oh, that's great.
Yeah, this is the best wine I've ever had or whatever. And you're like, first of all, that's impossible. Second of all, like, be honest with me. And, like, I have a couple friends that, like, I will, you know, whether it's blending trial time or even, like, something later, like, tell me what you really think. And they'll tell me what they really think, and I always appreciate that. But I also appreciate compliments, too. I'm not going to lie. It's not like, I'm not like,
you're anything lying. Creative. You always want compliments.
Sure. Yeah.
But you also want to get better. So then that's where, like, the construction feedback comes in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm my biggest critic, for sure. So that's hopefully enough to keep me driving. So, like, I have this whole philosophy in wine that, like, since there's no such thing as, like, the best ever winemaker, right? There's no Michael Jordan of wine, Tiger Woods of wine, whatever the analogy is. And so, since there is no best ever, that means that there's always room for improvement because no one's ever figured it out. After thousands and thousands of years, you think there would be a person or there, here and there, that's the person that figured it out.
Yeah.
And so, that concept of not being able to figure it out and always have room for improvement is what pushes me to continue to push myself. So that into itself is pretty motivating.
Yeah.
And you're kind of always the student of your craft, which is kind of cool too.
Well, because not only is wine so subjective, right, based on, like, what person is drinking it, but then every year is different too.
Yeah.
And so you have new challenges every year.
Yeah, and that's why we abandoned any, like, formulaic winemaking.
Yeah.
Because there is no... There is no control, right? And in any experiment, there has to be a control for the experiment to be valid, right? So, because the vintages are different year to year, even if they're minor, they're still different.
Mm-hmm.
Since you can't have a controlled vintage, there's no standard to set, so there's no reason to I don't take down any information. We don't keep a log. We don't do anything when it comes to fermentation, because it doesn't matter. Because next year it's going to be a whole new set of challenges.
This label is so pretty.
Thank you.
It's so subtle. Yeah.
As you turn it,
yeah, like a different texture. Yeah, it's awesome.
So this is the Escol Pinot Noir. So the other one being the Central Coast. This is a 2017 single vineyard Escol Pinot Noir.
This one's much sweeter to me.
Like, in what sense? Like, what do you taste?
Like, it's like a Jolly Rancher. Mm. Like that kind of sweet, like
a little more candied.
Bit of tart in the
yeah.
17 was a little bit more of a, for Pinot at least, a little bit more of a subtle vintage red fruit. Good length, though. I like this wine.
I could drink the entire bottle.
Yeah, go for it.
Easily.
Let's just all sit here and watch.
Call my husband. I need a ride.
I need a ride. Uber.
To me, this one smells more Pinot-y.
Yeah, the 17s were definitely more like classic.
Yeah.
16 was a warmer, bigger vintage in general.
Like, I feel like I want to just drink this one, and I want to have the last one with like a little food.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the opposite.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I feel like for the Escol, like, I can see like a mushroom ravioli with like a sage butter kind of thing.
That's so funny, because I was thinking mushrooms with the last one.
Yeah. I think with the last one, because it is a little bigger, like a pork shank, like something savory and kind of fatty.
What's your favorite wine to make?
Probably Syrah.
Syrah.
I've been doing it the longest. I feel like maybe it's more predictable for me because I have more experience with Syrah than I do other varietals. I really love making Grenache too. Grenache it proposes a unique set of challenges. And so we always look at it under a different light. And so that's always kind of a fun thing during harvest, when, especially when things can be repetitive, like to bring Grenache. Once you start bringing Grenache in, like, you know, some of the techniques change and approaches and whatnot. And so
I love Grenache.
Me too.
I think it's one of my favorites. And I think maybe I was thinking about this actually the other day, because I drank I don't remember whose it was, but it was delicious. Thanks, whoever made this beautiful bottle of wine I drank. And I was like, I think maybe I like it more now because I hated it so much. It was disgusting. It's the only wine I've ever actively spit out of my mouth.
Oh, wow.
And it was my first experience that I remember with Grenache. So then I was just like, oh, I don't like Grenache, because it was so bad. I did accidentally tell the winemaker that one time at a dinner. Oops.
Your Grenache is terrible.
I didn't. I was like, oh, I spit that out, and I tasted it. It was so bad. And then later, the owner's son, who I know, was like, that was the winemaker. I was like, oh, God. Like, no, they appreciate, me.
We appreciate honesty.
Never know who people are?
That's better.
Yeah. But, and then once I finally got over that mentality, now I love it and I want it all the time.
Yeah. Grenache is a really beautiful varietal. Like, it can be so, it's a funny grape, because it can be a very prestigious, like, standalone or blended varietal. You think about Gigondas and Chateauneuf or Pierrot, or even, you know, Westside Paso Robles in a lot of cases. It can be this beautiful thing, but it also in other areas can be just bulk quantity, like just filler grape that has no identity whatsoever. And so, like, not many grapes have that spectrum, you know, of use.
Yeah.
But when you really, like, think about Grenache and let it be Grenache. So I think for a while there, a lot of the winemaking in Grenache and farming in Grenache was to make it something else. Like, it wasn't dark enough, it wasn't big enough, it wasn't like present enough. And really, in my thoughts, if you let Grenache be Grenache, is when it's actually its best. And so let it be a little bit lighter, let it be a little bit more feminine. You really have to manage the tannins in fermentation with Grenache, because it can be really bitter. But once you kind of, like, commit to that and let it be what it is, it's when it becomes most beautiful, I think. So this is Grenache. Central Coast.
Speaking of.
Speaking of. Look at that segue.
So this is where we switch to Nell.
Yeah, so we're switching gears to Rhone varieties, which will be all Nell. Technically, we started with the white, which was Nell. That is a little more of a bonus one because it's not bottled yet.
If there's no label, it doesn't count.
It doesn't, yeah. Shiners don't make good podcasts.
Oh, gosh. That's really good. So the Cordon is only Pinots, and then everything else is Nell.
Rhone varieties for Nell.
Okay.
Yeah, so we don't make Cab or Zin, or like it's not just whatever else. It is pretty specifically Rhone varieties. I mean, if I made a Zinfandel for some reason, it would probably go under Nell. It seems like a better fit than a Pinot brand. But for now, it's just Rhone varieties. And then I started another brand we're calling Lady Amherst, and that's going to be Chenin Blanc and a Grenache Rosé. So going a little bit different direction.
I like that wine has... Like, it seems like that's a common thing. Like, oh, this label is going to be dedicated to this, and this label is going to... And I think that's so cool, having that freedom, and, like, it adds another level of creativity to it. Because you get to kind of create an image for this wine that's specific to it.
Sure. That, for me, too, it's like, wine is the full package. Like, as much as, you know, you want to just be like, what's in the bottle is the only thing that matters, which is really, you know, it's 90% of it. But that other 10% is really important. Of for packaging and branding and all that stuff.
For
and so, you know, sometimes you have a different vision, and if you don't stop thinking about it, then you should do it. And so, like, I had an idea for this brand for years, and for Lady Amherst, and this was the year where I was like, I'm pulling the trigger. I can't stop thinking about it, so I should do it.
Yeah.
And to me, it alleviates some of the pressure, too, in the long term. Like, some maybe you just get a good 10-year run out of something, and then it runs its course, and you just do something else or whatever.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that for Nell or Cordon, because I feel as though those things are, I hope to pass them on one day if I can, if I'm lucky enough.
Well, I think you guys are doing an awesome job with your labels and stuff. Like, they're all, the Cordon was so clean that, like, it catches your eye, and I feel like if I was at the store... Like, that would be appealing to me. And then these are adorable. And, like, I like that they're colorful. Well, the one's colorful. And, like, but they're, again, like, I would take that to dinner. If I had no idea what was in it, I would still buy it and take it to dinner somewhere because it has, like, an appealing label. There's nothing worse than, like, I brought you this bottle of wine. I know it looks ugly, but I promise it tastes good.
Yeah. Like, no, it's important, especially with, like, you know, being a millennial, an elder millennial, I call myself.
Like, millennial.
Yeah.
I like it.
But, like, how are we going to market to the biggest group of people? And part of it is
make
aesthetics.
It
that, you know, that generation, our generation, presumably,
is
coming of age and, you know, having disposable income a little bit and, you know, hadn't gotten through for some of us that first portion of kids, and so you're coming out of that, like, the toddler baby phase for some of us. I know a lot of my friends are in that phase of life, and so, yeah, things change, and now it's, let's get serious about trying to sell them things, because they were, like, feared for so long, it seems like. It's kind of unfortunate, you know? It's like, and now it's like, again, as in this elder millennial generation that I identify in, as Zennial or whatever they call it, it's like, I'm so sick of, like, people being, oh, millennials or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, hold the fuck up. Like, I got a couple bucks. Like, you don't want to sell me something? Like, because you think I don't get it? Like, so it's a little, we got to start changing our verbiage a little bit and how we talk to this group of people.
Yeah. I get it a lot at the salon because most of my clients are, like, my mom's age.
Yeah.
And I definitely hear a lot about being a millennial. I'm like,
you're
an older millennial. And
shut up, boomer.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I don't recall a generation, like, having beef like this before.
Well, you gotta think about the hippies, right? Like, the hippies probably had so much. Like, eventually, most hippies. I know some old hippies now because I'm friends with their kids that are freaking awesome, but they're probably, like, not taken seriously for a long time.
Yeah.
And
most of the old hippies I know are now, like, super rich.
Yeah.
Like, they had their hippie phase, and then they, like, stopped smoking weed and started, like...
Yeah, there were some non-hippies that got rich, too. So, it just, I think, is, like, either you have the work ethic or you don't. But, you know, I don't know. It's a different dynamic. But aesthetics are definitely important.
Oh, I think it's... No. I mean, I get paid to make people look prettier, so yeah. I'm a big fan of it.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Is there a story behind this particular label?
Yeah, so again, Nell being named after my mom, a lot of the Nell labels have some kind of family or my history in it. And this is a family heirloom piano that I grew up with in the house I grew up in, which will come up in a little bit. And now is in my house. And it's just like my great-grandmother's and my grandmother's and my mom's, and now it's ours. So it's just something I grew up with that had an impact on my life. Music is a very important factor in my life. Outside of wine and family, music is like maybe a third. Like, it's probably family, food, wine is one category, and then music. And it's not that distant apart from one another. And I think having growing up in a house where there's a piano, there's always instruments, and none of which I know how to play, I think still had an impact on my life and my love for music. And so we put the piano on the label for the Grenache.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love a story.
Yeah, and that's another thing, not to harp on the millennial thing too much, but the idea of like you offering experiences, right? And
oh, for sure.
That's such an important thing in the upcoming generation, right?
It is. Like,
what kind of experience do you offer people? And that's why we mentioned earlier, we try to offer lunch for people sometimes and sit down tastings, taste over here, taste over there, like different experiences when you walk in the door is kind of like the name of the game, especially in a very small space. Like how many different experiences can we offer?
It makes you want to come back. Like sure. If I know that next time I come in, I'm going to have a different experience, like then it's not like repetitive. It's not like, okay, yeah, I'm just going to like bust this out, drink the wine, buy a couple bottles and leave. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, what's
going to happen this time? Well, our whole philosophy on hospitality is make sure that people come in here that they lose track of time.
Yeah.
Like that they're like, oh shit, we got to be somewhere 15 minutes ago. Like that's my favorite thing to hear. Sorry, other wineries that are expecting these people. But like that tells me we're doing our job, that you've abandoned your phone, you've abandoned social media, you've abandoned time.
You're
present. Like if we can accomplish that in our interaction with people, then we know we're doing our job.
Yeah.
So. And sometimes we'll even ask early, you guys got somewhere to be after this? Mm-hmm. And we'll make note of it. And then we cater that exact experience to know that they need to be somewhere.
Yeah.
And so we try to be considerate. But at the same time,
Do you guys prefer that people make reservations?
Not necessarily. I think that if you're in a larger group, anywhere you go, you should give people a heads up. So I think if you're eight or more, you should let people know, whether it's us or anybody, just if anybody's listening. No, we don't require it. And like I said, we don't turn people away.
So how did you get into winemaking? Because like you, obviously you do this, but then it sounded like you were a winemaker for other labels in the past.
Yeah. I was always like cellar master, assistant winemaker, other places. Never was actually a head winemaker anywhere else. But I got into wine by waiting tables.
Oh.
And so my introduction to food and wine was working at a country club as a teenager. And I tried some wines that people ordered one night because I complimented the wine they ordered and they're like, oh, have some. And yeah, like, just sounded cool to excuse to drink on the job when you're 19 years old. But I remember in one night, someone offered me a taste and I said yes and I tried it and it made an impact on me. I remember thinking this is actually really good, 19 years old. And then I did it the same night to a different bottle of wine. Oh, great choice, one of my favorites, like, don't know, really. They're like, oh, have some. I'm like, oh, it worked again.
I have never shared wine with a server.
I always do.
You should start.
I always do.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I tried wine, the second wine, and I remember they were different. And that to me was like, why are they different? And that question of why are they different was really what got me into wine. Because when you look at the selection at the grocery store or whatever.
Right.
And you're like, are all these different? Turns out most of them aren't that different at the grocery store. But once you get into like wine shops and interesting restaurants, you do learn that a lot of these wines are actually really different. And the question of why are they different was really what snowballed my interest in wine. Because then I was like, oh, they're different places and there's different years and there's different varietals and there's different people and there's different like vineyards, same vineyards, different parts of the vineyard. And you can get so deep into why wines are different that how do you not generally get curious through that?
Yeah.
So. And then that was when I was 19, and so I became obsessed with wine fairly young, to the point where I got a job at a wine shop eventually because that was my passion. And I became the buyer eventually because I was good at my job, and then I topped out there pretty quick and was like, well, what's next? And it was either become a sales rep or a SOM or a buyer for a restaurant or something, and I was just, like, winemaking, the blue collar side of the industry was so much more appealing, like to be able to actually put energy into creating the products rather than selling them. Although that, I learned pretty quickly that you have to do both when you make it, which I don't mind. And then, you know, that's what really called to me. So then I moved to this area and thought I was going to go to school, and I didn't, and just ended up working for other people and learning from them and figuring it out along the way the best I could. Yeah, apprenticeship, and I think there's something to be said about that. I'm not a classroom person. No. Like, I've known that since I was very young.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't, if you would have told me when I was 17, about to, you know, 17 going on 18, about to graduate from high school, that I was going to be a winemaker and then go to school for this and get it going, I probably would have I would have dropped out and not done it, because I would have hated the classroom setting.
Yeah.
And so to go the route I did was definitely catered to the way my brain works. And so, and then I think too, with winemaking, it's like, once you learn that it's intuitive more than anything else, and you can adopt that philosophy, it starts to kind of click a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you kind of continue that on with, like, who you have working with you? Or are you trying to, like...
Sure. I'm very vague with my cellar master. I'm gonna figure it out. But don't fuck it up. Like, you gotta, like...
It's gotta come out well. Yeah. I'm not gonna tell you how to do it.
Yeah, I'll tell you the least I can. And if it doesn't, you don't do it right, I'll let you know. But if you're doing it right, I will not let you know. And I also very openly tell him and Amber sometimes, because I'm very involved in the front of the house too. I have a specific, you know, I like things done a certain way. And a lot of that is from experience and working different places over the years and seeing what I like and what I don't like. And but I will micromanage, and I will tell you, okay, micromanagement alert, I'm about to micromanage you, here we go. And I lay it all out there. Like, and to me, there's something in the cellar, one of the most important qualities to have is just good habits.
Yeah.
Like, the wine will tell you how it wants to be made if you're paying attention, and that's how that happens. But the little things are what determines whether it gets contaminated, whether it comes out good, or whether things are being done in the right time. And so the habits are so important. And so I will get more upset with the hoses not being hung right than I will something that comes to, like, that you would think would be more impactful. Mm-hmm. Because if your hoses are crossed, say you're coming out of your press pan into a small vessel and your hoses are crossed along the way, I will make you stop everything, walk the hoses out, unhook them, and put them right. Even though the pump works perfectly fine with crossed hoses, but the idea of them, that you didn't take the time to do it right, is what's the problem. And so if that's important to you, then just imagine with the things that actually matter. And so habits are the most important thing in the cellar, in my opinion.
This is delicious.
Thank you.
I love this.
2016 Central Coast Raw. The house I grew up in, where the piano was when I was a kid.
Very cool.
And my mom still lives in there. And so we still go there every so often. In Sanger, California.
Oh, and, I work with a girl from Sanger.
Yeah?
Yeah. You don't hear it very much.
No. No, you do not. Not around here.
No.
But that's where I grew up. Real quick, next wine is called the Bedlam. And this is a blend of Syrah, Grenache, and Petite Syrah. It's a new wine for us. It's a mixture of different various co-fermentations that we did during that year, which is kind of cool. And we did a kind of a different label, different color, colorful thing. My vision for this is actually a spinoff brand altogether, maybe more geared for distribution. So like a Bedlam Red and a Bedlam White, and it just be like however many we can sell, that's how much we make, kind of thing over the years. But in the meantime, this is fun, cool red blend that we do in the tasting room that's actually really cool and overperforms for the price. That's kind of the mantra for this wine, is overperform. It retails for $32, wine club is around $25, and it's just juicy and good and fun to drink. And
yeah, that's delicious. It's not what I was expecting, something like much heavier and bigger.
Yeah, no.
But it's we don't make any of our super approachable.
My whole thing too is like, it's not hard to like, Past Robles seemed to be this competition for a while, who can make the biggest wine, and it's like, that's only so good.
Yeah.
Like, and then you're not really showing nuances in your wines, you're not showing any kind of like effort, you're just like picking it late. and throwing some really aggressive yeast at it and then punching it down 3 or 4 times a day. Like, that's sinneying it heavily, throwing in a lot of heavy toast barrels. Like, that's not hard to do. And so to make a wine that, like, has presence but is really approachable at the same time is, like, that to me is hard. So, like, that's, you know, if I could start focusing on that now when I'm 45 or 50, like, I could be really good at that. And that, to me, is how you make good wine. So
I feel like my mom would like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mom approved for sure.
I definitely think she would.
No, this is super approachable.
Yeah, it's very nice. I've got a little passenger that also thinks it's nice, so I'm drinking around him.
Here, just dump it right in here and I'll pour you a fresh
one. Oh, no, it's okay. I gotta drive, but okay. I just wanted to sip.
Thank you so much for, like, sharing all this. Your wine is delicious.
Thank you so much.
I can't wait to tell people to come here and come back. Bring my husband. I think he would like it.
Bring him anytime.
Yeah.
I think the last thing, so, like, all your prices are listed here, and they're all very, very reasonable. What is your tasting fee?
Well,
does it depend on people's personalities?
Yeah. kind of, yeah. So we're, it's, I think it's $15 unless you're an asshole.
Okay.
Like, if you're an asshole, it's more, but, no, it's kind of the typical, like, if you buy something, there's no fee. And so,
that's cool.
Yeah. And even then, like, sometimes we get people that are on a bicycle and it doesn't make sense for them to buy one, but they've been really cool, or we think they'll come back, or we've had journalists come in or people that write blogs, and it's like, you're not really out and about, you're out to get content. And so, maybe it doesn't make sense to buy or whatever. So I don't really even know. Short answer. I don't really care. Just come in and have a good time, and if you buy wine, great. If not, then we'll figure it out.
Being on a bicycle should not prevent you from buying wine, though, because I once, like, bought a half case and just put it in my backpack.
Yeah. I agree. They have, like, a couple of those rides around here where it's, like, they're riding for, like, 100 miles or whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. But then why are they stopping in for wine?
I don't know, but
Because they're in Paso doing it.
I have a little bit more respect for people who like me riding 100 miles but also want a wine taste. Like, I like you.
Yeah.
I hate sharing the road with them a little bit less.
Well, I always say share the road means you too. Like, you can't just, like, be, like, going uphill in the middle of the road and be like, you're supposed to share the road with me too.
Yeah, no.
Sharing is not a one-way street, okay, like, bicyclist?
Buddy, if I hit you, you will die.
Yeah.
I might scratch my car and be inconvenienced, but you're dead.
Okay? Even if I'm texting, I won't even notice. So, like, come on, like,
think about
you and your family are going to be, like, mourning you forever.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to be pushing send. Like, so get the fuck out of my way. All right? Like,
agreed.
Yeah.
So, actually, really quick, too, like, tell us about your wine club.
So, yeah, it was super simple. Again, 6 bottles twice a year, 20% off.
Customizable, or?
Not really, but, like, if you really don't want something, we're not going to, like, we'd rather sell you something. So, of course, we would listen. But we'll always twist your arm into, like, you know, because we have people that we don't like Pinot. It's like,
really?
Had our Pinot. Like, oh, we don't like Syrah. We had our Syrah. Like, come on, like, don't be that
open-minded,
way.
Open-minded, yeah.
Yeah, if you're just like, I really want these things, then yes. But if you're like, I don't like these things, then we'll probably be, nah, we're good. But at the end of the day, like I said, we just want you to leave with something. Twice a year, we have, we really try to have a really great pickup party or release party every twice a year and really make those special. We do some interesting dinners. I would say signing up for our general mailing list would be a good idea, because we do like a monthly, we do like a little newsletter, nothing too much, but we have some reserve wines that we don't put in the wine club that we release through emails.
Yeah.
Like our whites and rosé are not put in the wine club, so the only way you can find out about the release of those is through the email list. And that requires no obligation other than receiving a monthly email.
Cool.
So,
awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Central Coast Uncorked. We hope that you enjoyed it as much as we enjoy drinking wine for your benefit. And if you did, we hope that you will rate, review, and even subscribe if you feel motivated to do so. Doing that helps us keep this going and also gives us the external motivation that we need. We will see you next week.